Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 765. My name is Camden Busey. I am in Libertyville, Illinois, at the Reformed Forum headquarters. And I have with me our Director of Education and Advancement, Ryan Noah, in studio as well. Hey, Ryan, how's it going today?
Hey, it's going great, Camden. So happy to be here.
Thank you. We're making our incremental improvements here in the studio. We just had Mark Winder in Friday night and Saturday to teach a course on Zephaniah. We had how many people total, counting all of us? I guess it was
eight registered students plus a few staff members. So it was an intimate time of fellowship and an intense time of meditating upon God's word and the great day of the Lord in Zephaniah.
Goodness.
So it was wonderful. And Lord willing, the first of 66 plus, not that there are more than 66 books in the Bible, but 66 plus courses.
Might have to have multiple courses on some of the larger books.
Right.
Yeah, I thought it was great. It was great. It was a wonderful experiment to do an in-person event that way here in the studio. And now we're trying to put everything back together as we were using equipment for that. Now we're back in the studio getting things lined up to talk to our special guest today. We're welcoming back to the program. Now, I think he's been on third time, maybe the fourth time. We have Dr. Corey Brock. Corey Brock's part-time lecturer in systematics and preaching at Edinburgh Theological Seminary. He's also a minister at St. Columba's Free Church in Edinburgh there. Welcome to the program, Corey. It's good to see you again.
Thanks, Camden. Great to be back.
Yeah, thanks for putting up with us, and we're delighted to speak with you. And since I think the last time you now have begun your podcast speaking about Bavinck and all things neo-Calvinism, along with Grace Otanto, James Eglinton, and what's the other, your other
Marinus
colleague?
De Jong.
Of course. He's actually Dutch, so...
Wonderful
insights there, even ministering currently in a continental context. So it's delightful to listen to that podcast. We'll have a link in the episode description to that. But how have things been going for you on the podcast, in scholarship, and just in life in general since the last time we spoke?
Yeah, thanks for that. I moved from the U.S. to Scotland to pastor here. I was a minister in Mississippi last time we talked, my home state, and back in Edinburgh again for the second time. And yeah, we love living here, ministering a church right on the Royal Mile, and it's a huge international festival outside the doors right now, so there's hundreds of thousands of people walking up and down the streets while I sit just on the other side and chat with you guys about theology and all things.
Sure.
So yeah, it's great.
I was just joking with my wife because, you know, I did this. I gave the Mormons my DNA a while ago, you know, with the Ancestry.com thing. My dad got a DNA kit thing and gave some of us, some of his kids, one of these things. But my current percentage just dropped. As they learn more things, they keep altering your ethnicity percentage. But I'm currently 19% Scottish, so... That part of me is really envious of you at the moment.
Yeah. Well, you'll come over and we'll have you and host you, take you around the Highlands.
I'll be 1/5 ecstatic.
Yeah.
No, thank you so much. I'm glad you're able to meet with us overseas. It never surprises me now, but it used to, that typically our guests that patch in from the UK or from even the continent somewhere, they typically end up having a better internet connection and look much sharper and crisper than the people that we connect to even from next door. Who knows why the internet works that way, but you're looking sharp today. We're glad to have you. A couple things to note before we get started. Obviously, keep your eyes open on the website for upcoming courses. We will work our best to get the Mark Winder course edited. Our video assistant, Karik, is heavily at work before he leaves for college. So we're trying to get through the footage before he heads out and hope to have that up in a month or so. That one will come a lot quicker. We're right on the edge of finishing the Machen course that Daryl Hart taught. The videos have been done for a bit, but we're just working on some supporting materials, right, Ryan?
Yeah, we've changed up how we're doing our subtitles and, you know, foreign language subtitles. So that's taken a little bit longer. But Lord willing, we're going to have three brand new courses in Reformed Academy before our conference. We'll have the Mark Winder course on Zephaniah. We'll have the Machen course with Daryl Hart. And we'll have Common Grace and the Antithesis right, which is part of our fellowship in Reformed Apologetics with Dr. Lane Tipton.
The fourth Van Til course will be, that's videos are done on that. Well, we just need to export them and then do the things we need to do to integrate it into our online platform. So that's just a reminder to everyone. That's Reformed Academy, which is a section of our website. All those courses are entirely free. Just register for a free account. You can take all the courses. They're all in video. We're working on podcasting them as well, just lesson by lesson, thinking about best ways to do that. If you have thoughts or suggestions, send us a note at mail@reformedforum.org, and we'll try to take those into account. And many, many more courses to come in the future. Looking forward to getting that done. And Ryan did mention our conference October 1st. The conference is then. Early bird rates are still available. Visit reformedforum.org/conference the end of the month, August 31st, 2022, I think is the cutoff for the early bird rate. And there's still tickets available for the pre-conference event Friday night, September 30th. If you'd like to come to that and come to a private dinner and hang out with the speakers and some other people, that'd be a great time and place to do that. So looking forward to having everyone with us. If you have any questions, hit us up on email or Twitter. All right. Well, thanks for bearing with us, Corey. Let's get down to the to the meat of our conversation today. We're pulling up the Confessional Presbyterian Journal, issue number 17. It's so awesome that they're now on 17. I remember when it first started, they thought maybe do 4 or 5, and even if they did that, they'd have a handsome kind of collection for the bookshelf. To see that it's been coming out annually for quite a long time is wonderful. And now we're seeing the journal expand into other areas. It's been picked up by Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary. So wonderful to have that additional support institutionally so that the journal can continue to flourish and grow and hopefully expand into wider markets, if that's the right term. But today we're looking on page 10 of the Confessional Presbyterian Journal 17, Hope for the Modern Self, on Bovink's Christian Science. Now, Corey, I didn't know Bovink was into the Christian Science movement and all that stuff. No, clearly we're not talking about what Mary Baker Eddy, I think was her name. New agey views on, you know, the transitory illusion of life. You know, if you're sick, then it's something wrong with your mind.
It's like Buddhist Christianity. it's not worthy of the name Christian.
Yeah, we're not talking about any of that, but we're speaking more specifically about different disciplines, sciences, as we understand them in contemporary language, you know, the sciences, natural sciences, but also speaking about epistemology. Corey, could you just set the table for us a little bit on Christian Science, at least in terms of how we're using that term in this particular article, and then we can branch out into how Bovink really advances the discussion in some interesting ways.
Yeah, so there's a Christian Science Center on the main shopping road here in Edinburgh, the type that you were describing just a moment ago.
I always have the reading
rooms. I
wondered
if I could get them to display this book in the front window, sort of a subversive witness sort of idea. But this is an article I wrote to introduce to the English-speaking world a book that James Eglinton, Grace Otanto, and I have translated. We're about 95% done. The translation's been done. If anybody from Crossway is listening, I apologize on behalf of the group because they've been waiting on it for some time now. But this is a book he wrote in the same year as Christian Worldview. And he writes it late in the year. It's really a follow-on to the Christian Worldview volume. So it's going to be published alongside Christian Worldview as a couplet with Crossway in English. And like you said, Camden, he uses the Dutch word that we would translate science, but in English, as is often noted, it's not as clear as in German and Dutch. Wetenschap is the word from Dutch, like Wissenschaft, right? And of course, it means something different for Bovink than it would for the normal modern listener. And it means for him a much more holistic pursuit of knowledge, like it meant, the term science meant in the pre-modern world. So we're assuming here a distinction between what happened to the sciences in the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution and the turn towards what's called positivism, radical empiricism of sorts, that changed the definition of what science means from what it meant in a more classical way. What Bhavink really means here is just simply an extension of the philosophical endeavor. And that's why dogmatics, Christian theology is science, just like literature, literary studies are science, even in their search for something like the ethical good in a novel, that's a science, you know, anything with an object to know. So that's a very brief, broad, cursory explanation of what he means by it. But of course, the whole book is really about explicating the true nature of science and how science could be, how could we attach such a strong adjective, excuse me, like Christian to this word. So
no, it's I appreciate the, these are themes that obviously Bhavink is his own man working here, but you know, one of my favorites is Cornelius Van Til. We love him here. So I'm not seeking to anachronistically import Van Tilian themes back into Bhavink. Rather, the other way, we're finding the more and more we dig into primary sources, we see it goes the other way a lot. Bhavink appropriates or is appropriated by Van Til in many different ways. So there's some themes here that are interesting to me for other reasons. But there are so many connection points between Bhavink's thoughts on Christian science here and the present day, especially we think about the world post-COVID and all the epistemological and even really tribal aspects going on. We're seeing epistemology work out in various ways. People are questioning the nature of a fact now, and all sorts of things that are coming to the fore in very practical, tangible methods. I think this article and Bhavink's book is going to have a different platform. And it's going to be useful and applicable, beneficial to the world in ways that perhaps it wasn't back then. But that's what I want to dig into from an historical, theological perspective. I'm curious what Bhavink is reacting to. Perhaps what are the dominant paradigms in culture, but also in the academy? What is Bhavink responding to, perhaps philosophically, when he's approaching the natural sciences here from a specifically Christian perspective?
He's replying to what's dominant in the late 19th century in the academy, as it was dominant, we might say, in the early 2000s in the academy, with the rise of the second wave of militant atheism, both the Dawkins-esque atheism that we've lived through and passed by now was, there was a similar first wave of that in the late 19th century. And it was a product, of course, of Darwin, but of those that followed Darwin and others like John Stuart Mill and the philosophies underneath someone like that, that gave rise to a movement called positivism. And positivism essentially stated that that which cannot be sensed with the five senses cannot be known. And there's philosophical background to that, even though the scientific-oriented positivists didn't really understand that. And neo-Kantianism and people like, even from the theological side, someone like Ritschl. But Bhavink, let's put it in more popular terms, Bhavink really wants to undermine the arrogance of scientism in his own day. I mean, he calls these movements scientific Gnosticism. That there's this sort of division between normal people and the true knowers. And the true knowers are the elite academy, the positivists that are doing real science to the neglect of all the other people. So there was a real, he thought, elitist separation between the lowly people that just know the world in what he calls normal empirical knowing, and those that are doing positivistic oriented research. So, I mean, one of the things he wants to do with that is talk to the world of science and say, actually, the farmer that's been practicing their industry and their field for 50 years has a lot to say to the agricultural scientist that's in the laboratory all day. And that those two actually would be best working together. So there's a sort of an appeal to a phenomenological sort of Heideggerian sense here of mastery of a field and normal knowing. And he wants to say that the human person seeks to know organically, of course, as he always moves in that direction, holistically. And so he wants to cut through this divide between the arrogance of the rise of the scientific academy and scientism and normal human life, and say that actually science needs to go back to its roots, which is what arose with philosophy in the classical period.
Mm. Yeah, that's wonderful. You're really setting forth the Bavinck's polemical context here. And as long as we're on the subject of positivism, and Camden mentioned presuppositions a moment ago, something that struck me in your article was your description of positivism as having an absolute demand for presuppositionlessness. And so I wonder, brother, if you might further unpack that antithesis between an unbelieving approach to science and one that is self-consciously built upon a foundation of faith. What presuppositions are necessary per Bavinck for the right and true science? And how does Bavinck's approach on this question contrast with that of his opponents who want to eschew all presuppositions? I mean, what arrogance.
So the way that he goes about this is not to immediately assert specifically Christian claims from the outset, but try to first undermine a radical empiricist claim that there is such a thing as the separation between someone who is religious and dogmatic and someone who is objective and scientific, right? So he wants to cut through that and say, that's not a choice that anybody can make, that everybody is at the bottom a person of faith, and that religion is actually always fundamental to any scientific endeavor to some degree and in some way. And so I guess there's so much I could say here, but I mean, one of the things that he wants to say is that faith is at the bottom, is the presupposition. He's using a German term there, presupposition less or presupposition. Faith is at the bottom of all knowing, is what he tries to argue towards the contemporary academy of his time, the positivistic oriented academy of his time. So I jotted down a few quotes just so I thought it might be good for people to just get a little snippet of the book.
Sure.
So here's one on this particular topic. The reality of the world outside of us is fixed by and for faith. Its assumption is a deed of trust in the deepest ground of trust in the truthfulness of God. After all, the outside world is only given to us in our psychical representations. We are not able to compare these with the outside world itself. We cannot withdraw from ourselves. We must simply believe that in these representations, a real knowledge of the world is offered to us. Right. So you can hear in that Bavinck's going a little bit of an idealist, idealist route, and saying that the problem with positivism is that it can't even grapple. It refuses to grapple with the philosophical reality that even representations stand in the way of absolute objectivity. You know, that sensation, for Bavinck at least, forms in us a representation that cannot be said to be the world in itself.
Yeah, the Ding an sich, little Kantian message there.
Yeah, so there's a slight lean towards Kant in saying that, but of course he's going to come back around.
Sure.
And say the problem or the solution to all this is actually that you need a metaphysic that can give you an epistemological confidence in representations and their union with the objective world, right? And he's going to ultimately appeal to the logos, by which he means the word of God in the upholding of the human consciousness
and even the Trinity, perhaps in the organic display of that. Analogously, we also find the Trinity and its vestiges throughout creation. So it's really wonderful to see how an Orthodox Christology, yes, but even behind that, an Orthodox Trinitarian theology provides a foundation for Bavinck for understanding the whole natural world. See, this is where, you know, then they start to, for me, get into all the Van Til stuff. But Van Til is drawing so heavily on Bavinck on this, there could be questions as to how congruous they are, how congruent they are together. I think they're rather congruent, but that's for scholars to decide. But that's why Bavinck, for example, is not an idealist, you know, but he's not exactly just a realist either, or a Thomist. That this is the problem when you try to fit thinkers like this into these predetermined boxes. He's an Orthodox Christian who's engaging with modern philosophy and modern science, but doing so without compromising his theological and confessional principles.
Well, you sound like you're on the Grace and Common podcast right now. Kate.
I've been listening. but I love a lot of the themes because they're things I've thought of for a while, but you're, you know, expanding and broadening my horizons, I think, in a healthy way. And that's the hope, with our podcast discussions here, and why I'm glad you're doing it on yours as well. This is what theological conversation ought to do.
Yeah, indeed. Well, to pick back up on your comment about Trinitarian operations, the economic operations of the Trinity in the world, and on this point, I mean, he doesn't exactly do this in this book, but I mean, across the corpus, across the Kuiper's corpus, I mean, one of the appeals is, of course, to the common operation of the Holy Spirit, and they go to Calvin and Calvin's Institutes, where Calvin very clearly teaches a common operation of the Holy Spirit. So, you know, the possibility of knowing, the possibility and confidence we have in the agreement between the subjective and the objective, my consciousness and the world outside of me, for these guys, is the condescension of the Holy Spirit as the one who upholds the possibility of knowledge as a common grace gift, even after the fall. It's certainly a Trinitarian operation. And he explains that very clearly in Reformed Dogmatics, Volume 1, the theology that's standing behind the possibility of knowing anything at all.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, even aside from the overtly theological dogmatic aspects of this, he also just simply appeals to the fact that the positivists have to assume so much about an invisible world that they refuse to acknowledge, right? And so, he very simply appeals to Aristotle and Plato in that as well, and just says, look, in every single representation and then scientific claim, you're assuming the reality of abstract objects, of truthhood and falsehood, of number, of all sorts of immaterial realities, right? That you have never experienced, you've never seen, you've never touched, and you've never tasted. The possibility of essence and nature, the problem of induction, you know, of course, is being passed over here as if you could assert without experience that the same law holds true in multiple places at different times without actually being there, without experiencing it yourself. So he, you know, pulls the rug out, as many people have done since, of positivism and shown as we had to do again in the last 15 years in the Dawkins-esque movement, that such a scientism is, of course, absurd and silly and assumes so much of what it's trying to deny. So.
Mm-hmm. One thing that you didn't write explicitly in your article was about how the image of God, how Bavinck's anthropology relates to this whole question. But I was struck by just as you're speaking how these positivists are really kicking against the pricks, as it were, of their own being created in the image of God as they're making these scientific claims and assuming so much, all while denying their creator, in whose image they're created. And I had a question about your section on the hope for Christian science. You repeatedly use the language of hungering and thirsting for knowledge as part of the scientific pursuit, and as if knowledge, not just of empirical facts, but of their origin and their cause and their value was something that man, as created in the image of God, was instinctively driven to pursue and to know and to put in relation to the things that are unseen, the things that are above. And so I wonder if you might connect the dots for us a little bit between Bavinck's anthropology and Christian Science. And if a quote would help, this one really, really jumped out at me on page 11. You write, "But now she returns," she being the modern 19th century person, "climbing back up the ladder to the things above, which is for Bavinck a necessary ascent because the investigatory instinct of humanity toward facts never remains without the desire for unification by way of causation and value."
Yeah, right. So this is, it's a good question, good thought. This is 1904 and that he's writing. And I mean, one of the things that he regularly talks about, philosophy of revelation, Christian worldview, other places, is how at the turn of the century, there was a return. The way he puts it was a return from Darwin to Hegel, is how he often will phrase it like that. So he talks about how, although the positivists had won the day for a couple of decades, that there was a massive amount of people converting to Islam, Buddhism, theosophy, sort of a Hegelian spiritism of some sort, or Christianity. I mean, there was just a return to religious interest. I mean, it's amazing how cyclical humanity is. I mean, we're experiencing something very similar right now. You know, the secularization thesis has been shown to fail through numerous cycles, that people remain mostly religious. Edinburgh, where I live, is an incredibly secular. There are very few Christians here. Yet most people are not atheists, and they're just indifferent. They're broad general theists of some measure, agnostic theists, but indifferent. And Bavinck was kind of living in the same time where he was noticing that, and that was part of the impetus here. And so get what you were saying in that, of course, he's got the theological background and knowledge that he has, doctrine of the image of God, things like that. He goes there, but he doesn't only go there. He also, because we've got to remember the audience he's trying to appeal to as well, the people that have survived the positivist movement. He's also appealing to them as well by going back to the early philosophers and saying, we see this everywhere. You know, Christian theology tells us why, but also we look at what Aristotle said about humanity, what Plato said about human beings, and we see very clearly that human beings long to know. And so when he goes to define what science is, you know, what is this thing called science, he says that science actually begins in the normal path of empirical knowing that we all experience. We grow up as children, we start to, you know, create these little taxonomies. You know, I've got four kids, but one of mine's a 3-year-old. And as you guys, anybody with small children know, very quickly they start to become very inductive, and they start just, they go through this phase where all they do is tell you what something is.
Yeah.
That table, chair, dog, tree, right? And they're putting together their taxonomies of existence and reality, right? And that's normal. But Bavinck says that's normal empirical knowing. Then what happens to humanity because of who we are, created in the image of God, is that as God knows and we desire naturally to think his thoughts after him, we turn to philosophy. And so what he says is that philosophy is simply the attempt to know the essence and ideal, the call, the final cause, origin and purpose. And then science, these sciences, in the sense of what a university is, what a specialized research field is actually a product of philosophy. So I think a lot of times people think about it the other way around, that you do science and then philosophy gets birthed out of that. You move from physics to metaphysics, right? Well, Bavinck wants to say that actually you move from metaphysics to physics back to metaphysics is essentially the process that he sees. So he says that human beings, because of what they are in the light of God, want to know. We don't just want to know laboratory results. We want to know essences. We want to know causation. We want to know telos. And then, so we start to specialize our fields of research so that we can take the laboratory and then we can return to philosophy and have physics inform metaphysics all the more, right? But all of that, of course, for him works within a world and life view that it has to. So, you know, which is why he writes the books in the same year. So, yes, is that kind of where you were thinking?
Yeah, or, yeah. No, you're definitely hitting on where I was getting at. Just that, you know, science is whether people want to suppress the truth and unrighteousness or not. Science itself is a religious endeavor. It has to be. Either you're doing it as a covenant keeper or a covenant breaker, based on your being in Christ or in Adam, and it proceeds from your basic faith. So that's really helpful, brother. And as long as we're on the subject of the relationship between philosophy and science and theology and science, and I wanted to bring up a really just pithy quote from your article that I'd love for you to unpack further. You said that it's appropriate to speak of. Hold on, let me get this right. It's appropriate to speak of theology as both queen and servant of science. You spoke a little bit about how she's the queen. How is she also the servant of science? And how can theology put on these two hats, as it were, without misusing her power, to borrow another quote from you?
Yeah, so I mean, these are things that come from his book. These are, you know, ideas that come from him. By the way, Christian Science is the book title. It's going to come out translated Christian Scholarship and Publication. So I failed to mention that earlier.
Good to know.
Precisely so that we don't.
People, a lot of returns on this.
Yeah,
one.
A lot of potential returns. Yeah.
What is this book? This isn't anything of what the title says.
right, exactly. I don't know why. For some reason, your comment made me think of that. Theology as a servant of the sciences. So, what I think Bavinck is talking about there has a lot to do with his concept of a Christian worldview, of a worldview in general, of a world and life view. So for him, the way, this is not his words, but this is what I think he means by a Christian world and life view. I think for him, a worldview is when religion comes to bear upon science. Let me say first, philosophy, science, art, and ethics, if you want to break philosophy down a little bit. So when religion, when we allow religion to bear upon science, philosophy, art, and ethics, that's what Bavinck takes to be the beginning of a Christian world and life view and the task of a world and life view. That means that for him, the religious aspect, which of course for him it can never be separated from revelation, meaning that if there's a religion, there's a revelation that stands underneath that religion that provides the possibility of that religion, even if it's if that revelation's been misunderstood, like in the world religions, he would say. But nevertheless, those are inseparable, right? So religion and revelation go hand in hand. That means that there must be truth claims being made. So there's doctrine. There's a faith that comes with a body of doctrines. In other words, what happens is that religion has to form a map of meaning in which these other fields are allowed to operate for the knower, right? So so then when we've created this map of meaning, of course, that can have its boundaries shifted to some degree, because we're always changing, always learning. We know that our theological statements are never perfect, that we first confess the unknowability of God before we then start to talk about who God is. The map of meaning can shift its boundaries, but nevertheless, Christian theology or religion provides the boundaries of the map. And then the scientific enterprise, the philosophical enterprise, the work of art, verbavim, which means to produce things, and our moral life all operate within that map of meaning, if you will. And that means that theology gives every other field a ground to walk on, sort of. You know, I mean, for him as a Christian, he wants to say that theology serves, is servant to biology or any other scientific enterprise, because it gives the philosophical power to actually make scientific claims, beginning with that there is truth and it can be known, and that subject can agree with object, and that I do have the powers in my sensational abilities to actually walk down a field, learn more about it. And of course, underneath all that, as servant, is the doctrine of divine ideas. And for him, and that we are enacting our God-given ability to think God's thoughts after him by knowing the world as he knows, right. of course, creaturely.
Via revelation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, via revelation, right? Mm-hmm. So all knowledge for him stands on revelation. There is no knowing anything except through revelation, in such a way, or exactly because of what we said earlier, the common operation of the Spirit, that that the condescension of God is actually the possibility of knowing, because it's the condescension of God that upholds the human capacity to know at any moment, no matter what a person believes in. So God gives the rain and the sun to the just and the unjust, just like he gives the brain and sensation and the objective world, right, and the representations to the just and the unjust.
Mm-hmm.
And so in those ways, theology serves everyone else. But at the same time, within that map of meaning, he also wants to say, we've made lots of mistakes in the past. We've let the theologians come and tell the scientists what to do, and in ways that are damaging, right? In ways that the theologians had no right to do because they don't know what they're talking about. And so he wants to say that, you know, within this map of meaning, there's a lot of space for science to work and to be free. And actually, there's a freedom within the fence, because you can proceed knowing that you really are finding out real true things, and you can make assertions about places and spaces that you have not yet been based on law because of the Noahic covenant or something like that, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that is the sort of thing he means, although he doesn't say what I just said, but I think that's what he's talking about.
Sure, sure. I'm curious and interested here to pick up on this section you have on the necessity of Christian science, particularly thinking historically, and I mean that in the general sense, but I'm also using that, I think we can dive down more specifically to speak covenant historically, or, you know, redemptive historically. So you point out in just a passing remark that wonderful and famous quote by Augustine on faith seeking understanding, and demonstrating that Bavinck would have thought that this activity is something that's historic. You know, you say, finally, because faith aims toward knowledge, because faith seeks understanding, the emergence of Christian science is not a mere response to modernist positivism, but an historic Christian practice, a necessity of life in a fallen world. Now, here's what I got an interesting question for. I'd love for you to elaborate. Without sin, there need not be Christian science at all. There would be no breach in the consciousness between religion and knowledge apart from the rupture-induced act of denying the word of God in the egocentricity of becoming like God in knowing good and evil. I'd love for you to expand on that, but also maybe this is opening up too big of a theme, but I'd love for you to consider this also in light of Bavinck's understanding of grace, maybe perfecting nature, not only restoring nature, but and curious on his theology of the new heavens and the new earth. And our finitude as humans, our glorification is not going to overcome our finitude. That's not a sinful thing. We're always creatures, and there is always going to be, I presume, in Bavinck's theology, opportunity for us to learn and grow in our knowledge. We can still, even in a glorified state, theoretically persist in scientific endeavors. So how then does that, how is that differentiated from the point that you're making here regarding Bavinck's book on Christian Science?
Yeah, well, when you read that quote, I think to myself, what did I mean when I...
No.
As you said earlier, Camden, before we started, that these articles are always written much a long time ago by the time we get to talk about
long
them.
Lead times. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, you're right. Certainly Bavinck, and I would agree, the neo-Calvinist kind of tradition emphasizes that we will continue to learn in the eschatological kingdom, and that would have been true, of course, of Adam and Eve as well, and was true of them. I mean, the difference, of course, in that and what I think I mean there is that sin has corrupted much, in
sure.
fact, everything, as Bavinck puts it, right? So the fact that he's writing a book that says we need this Christian Science is precisely because of sin. I mean, mm-hmm. because we don't think God's thoughts after him, because our consciousness has been ruptured. I mean, there's a little bit of a Schleiermacher reference in that, because he adopts Schleiermacher's language on this and says that the fall of humanity was the rupture of God consciousness and self-consciousness, so that the knowledge of self is no longer the knowledge of God.
Sure.
As it, and now that knowledge, of course, is not complete, mm-hmm. and never would have been. And of course that knowledge would have risen to new heights and some sort of in a consummative state if Adam were to have been obedient, but that I don't think, as you say, would have stopped the pursuit of the knowledge of God and of things even after. So, yeah, right. I mean, the need for Christian Science is of course for him a response to the fall and how it affects all of who we are. So there's of course an assumption there of the noetic effect of sin.
Yeah.
And all of the theology that stands alongside that, a very Augustinian, I think, take on post-fall anthropology.
So that antithesis and the fall into sin and presumably all the noetic effects of sin, the effects of sin on the mind, our minds our wills are affected. And we need the gospel. We need the work of the Spirit to restore us. And then also the work of the Spirit to glorify us and help us to, you know, by God's grace, transcend even the state into which Adam was first created. So, you know, when I read your quote, I was presuming, I wanted you to answer, but you did answer along the lines that I thought that you might, which I think is a helpful way to think in terms of just, I love that language you mentioned, a rupture. That there's such a beautiful organic whole, like all of reality fits in and founded upon the divine unity, that all of creation is sustained by the Lord, and the heavens declare the glory of the Lord. The earth is handiwork. And so we see God revealing himself not only in what he says, but in all the things that have been made, and specifically in his image, human beings, and then even more so climactically in his son, who is the perfect image of God. He's God himself. So sin brings into the mix just all sorts of divisions, and also it just tries to separate us from God, but also even our minds are not fully destroyed in an utter depravity sense, but we have a total depravity where there's all this compartmentalization. And I wonder, you know, I'm not, I've read a lot of Bavinck, but I wouldn't call myself a Bavinck scholar by any stretch. But one thing I do recognize and notice from him when I read him is just in God's providence and in God's design, everything is supposed to connect and be related and reinforce itself, reinforce one another. So there shouldn't be harsh and sharp distinctions among different scientia or knowledges, that there just are going to be more natural blends and you're not going to find compartmentalization so much. But with the effects of sin, much of this has become necessary. And now we need to speak of a Christian science, whereas before, it's not to say we wouldn't have needed science in the way that we understand it now, generally, but it wouldn't, we wouldn't have to call it Christian science, maybe, or we wouldn't have to shift gears and say, well, now let's operate in a different epistemological mode per se, but more in a God-directed Trinitarian, I guess, mode of thought. Just, it is faith seeking understanding. I guess maybe the short answer, if I want to put a point on my rambling, it's just how to be faithful in how we study.
Right. That's well said. I think, for in the light of what all that you just said, it's important to point out that his book, Christian Science/Scholarship, ends in the crescendo chapter 13 of The University. So the University is the final chapter. It's not the first, it's the last. And, I think that the reason for that is because of many of the things that you've just said. He's trying to justify a Christian university because he's just moved in 1902 to work at the Free University of Amsterdam.
Yeah.
And so he's trying to make sense of the need for such a thing.
Yeah.
But the fact of organic knowing, he's lamenting, in other words, that even though the university is the product of a Christian idea, it has fractured itself as well into such highly specialized departments that it's in some ways no longer doing the thing that it was made to do, which is to unify the organism of knowledge by specialization in order for reunification for the sake of knowers. Now, of course, we've got to be humble, and he recognizes that and talk about how each of us cannot know exhaustively. We can't apprehend even most of the things that that could be learned in different fields. But what he's trying to do is say that there's a reason that the university was born. And the reason the university was born is not because it's necessary. It's not necessary. He even says that science is not necessary in the strict sense. You know, science, like art, is not something we have to have. Instead, it arises quite naturally from humanity as the image of God, unto the point that it reaches the status of university, precisely because we were made to be organic knowers. And that's simply us, you know, the aspect of the image of God that remains in us even after the fall.
Mm-hmm.
And so the university for him is sort of a living image of the hope of eschatological life, if you could almost put it like that. It's sort of a human feeble attempt to try to manifest what we do actually long for.
Yeah. I like that a lot. It's an interesting historical point, a good reminder of his academic context or institutional context, perhaps driving some of his desire, some of his case here. I think it's interesting. Well, this remains to be seen by the public, but, expanding out and perhaps wrapping up our conversation, putting a point on it. But some of these themes are so, like, to folks like Ryan and I, this is no surprise. Like, we tend to think this way. Like, things should be connected. You should, you know, our thoughts and knowledge and our theology should have an impact upon all of life. Like, that seems common sense.
By God's grace.
By God's grace, of course. And I imagine most neo-Calvinists would think along those lines, too. Like, none of that should be surprising. Like, this is how it works. But then you find some of our you know, 2K friends and whatnot, other people that get really apprehensive about some of the misunderstandings. I might say excesses, but often they're misunderstandings of a neo-Calvinist position. Don't like to hear this sort of thing, and sometimes think that there's no room for common grace in the neo-Calvinist understanding. Here's where I'm going. You know, we'll say, well, if there's a Christian way, a faithful way that you're supposed to think about all of life, how can we account for all of these scientists, all of these other disciplines? The common example by one of our closer friends people will know is, well, is there a Christian plumbing? You know, if I have a leak in my pipe, do I have to call the Christian plumber who's going to do it correctly? Well, that's not the point. Like, obviously, even people that aren't pursuing things with a Christian science or a Christian discipline can still, through common grace, do an excellent and superb job. But without the theological foundations and even all these epistemological principles, they can't make heads or tails of their reality on their own terms. And I think, to me, at least that's the point here. Bovink isn't saying that if you didn't go to a Christian university thinking explicitly about epistemology in a Christian mode or Christian anthropology informing how we even go about our practice in the laboratory, he's not saying then all the scientific findings of the secular institution are worthless. No. But all those secular institutions would be more faithful and better scientists and understand their discipline much better and appropriately if they were doing it through Christ and doing it to his glory. I don't know. I'm sure, I mean, you've encountered and dealt with a lot of this, especially on early episodes of Grace in Common. Yeah. But do you have any additional thoughts, perhaps, as that common trope pops up, perhaps with relation to this particular article?
Yes, indeed. I mean, I anticipated that as soon as you use the phrase Christian science, that this, of course, is going to be brought up. Yeah, I mean, you know, I think it's important to have patience with the caricatures, and they are indeed often caricatures. I think I would invite those who go down that road of something like the Christian plumber question, just to go read Bovink, The Kingdom of God, The Highest Good, his essay, and he can cut through some of that. I think read Christian Worldview, read this book. I think that would really help. A lot of times what's happened in those caricatures, and I'll come back to address specifically what I think about how this book relates to those in, just for a moment. But a lot of times I think those caricatures are born out of not going back to maybe the best sources and not reading a Bovink or a Kuiper, not really. I mean, going in, and we can talk about the Kuiperian transformational kind of movement or whatever that might be, but you can't really find it in Kuiper, not the way it's often mentioned when you read the primary sources.
Yeah, so that, in context as well, not just picking
in context,
one sentence,
right? It's, I mean, you know very quickly that somebody has not quite yet grasped the distinctions when they talk about Kuiper chasing after a Christian state and things like this. Of course, Kuiper was fundamentally disestablishment from the beginning of his career. And so things like that. So I would just encourage, just read the primary sources and try to wrestle with the nuances. And you put it well, the nuances. I think the relationship between common grace and antithesis is so important for getting this nuance. Now, as it relates to Christian science, let's ask, what might this look like practically? So here's some examples. These show up in my new book with Grace Sutanto that's coming out in January, Neo-Calvinism, A Theological Introduction. So yeah. These are some things that we mention on this subject. So Kuiper asked this question, for example. You know, when a doctor approaches the sick bed, are they approaching the sick mammal or a person created in the image of God? And the answer to that question for a Christian makes a huge difference. Let's take it back a step. When the biological scientist approaches the question of of gene therapy, and I'm not a doctor or scientist, so I can't talk about these things very well, but worldview makes a lot of difference. And whether you go down the road of practicing eugenics, as Bobbing points out in Christian worldview, or not, right? So there's so much ethical determination within the scientific enterprise that it's absolutely critical. Of course, there's also intellectual determination that is judged within a specific religious worldview, right? So another one would be in the case of a lawyer, and this one is one that Bobbing brings up. In the case of a lawyer and judge, is the law a functionally developing organ of nature or a jewel coming down to us from God himself bound to his word, right? So there's a question. Or lastly, one that Bobbing's points to, Bobbing talks about evangelizing science, and he's being cheeky when he says something like that. But what does he mean? And this is what I think he means. He means that the Christian biologist must refuse to separate the inductive work of biological exploration from the Christian confession. You know, that theology cannot be cordoned off, pushed away into a small little place on the edge of the academy that says, this is not really knowledge. It can't be left as just discrete, but it must remain the organizing principle, even for the biologist, of all the sciences. And so this biologist can seek to be a witness to the unity of reality in the midst of her field through the way she practices and makes metaphysical claims that reach beyond just the inductive products of the research laboratory, right? And so I think when we investigate the types of claims that scientists make, we immediately learn that much of this is philosophical, and that means that it can be it has a religious bearing, right? And so so anyway, that I'm rambling now as well.
No, but that's important.
This is I would just, you know, I would say, before asking the question, do I call the Christian plumber, first read the primary sources, and then if disagreement remains, then excellent, right? You know, let's talk through it.
So, well, even if the non-Christian plumber comes and fixes your leak, he'll still have to account for it on judgment day.
Yeah. Well, let me give you one more example.
Because you didn't do it to God's glory.
Right. Let me give you one more example from my own life. When I was a minister in Mississippi, I knew we had the largest medical research facility right next to our church in the state. And there were so many people who came to the church I was ministering at from that were working at that facility. And some of them, for example, were psychologists. They were doing PhDs in psychology. They were lecturing in psychology. They were practicing in psychology. And so many of them would say all the time that in their psychological research and in their practice, they wanted to reach conclusions in the research and with people that they were disallowed to because of essentially a positivism. And that's that they wanted to simply say, look, I think you're struggling with idolatry, and it's quite obvious. And now that's not always the right answer, of course, but their Christian theology allowed them to see that sometimes particular problems were simply the products of very common idolatries that we see talked about in scripture or in Luther or Calvin. And so that would be a simple example of how I think theology comes to bear on science in the midst of practicing science, if you will.
Yeah, it absolutely does. That's tremendous. Well, this entire article is interesting and beneficial. I think it's encouraging. I think people ought to read it. Again, we're looking at the 2021 edition of the Confessional Presbyterian Journal, volume 17. Turn on over to page 10. And you will find this article, Hope for the Modern Self on Bobbing's Christian Science, by our friend, our guest today, Corey C. Brock. This has been really fun. I hope to have you back, perhaps when the new book on An Intro to Neo-Calvinism comes out, you and Greg can come back if you're willing. But Corey, thanks for taking the time speaking with us today. It's been a joy.
Yeah, we would love to do that. And it's, thanks for having me. Really enjoyed it.
Absolutely. It's our pleasure. We're delighted to have you with us. We're delighted that everyone's able to listen along and participate. Take a look at our other episodes that we have online. We'll have a link. If you click on Corey's name when you're looking at the episode description, you'll be able to find all the other episodes that he has participated in, as well as head on over to the website and find all of our new courses and other things that are available for free. And take a look at our publications. We have new books and other things coming out as well. So all of that's available online at reformedforum.org. Head on over and subscribe to the Grace in Common podcast as well. One place to do that, quite simply, you'll find it in all the different podcast directories. But you'll find the main page, at least the main podcast host, at anchor.fm/graceincommon4. And you'll be able to listen to all the episodes here from James Eglinton, Corey Brock, Marinus DeYoung, and Grace Atanto. It's really wonderful. You're on a little bit of a hiatus, I think, for the summer, right? Are you coming back in the fall?
We were texting today trying to decide if we were going to record this week. So I think it's coming up in the next couple weeks for sure.
Well, great. Yeah. We'd love to get those episodes back out, and I'll have a link to that as well in the episode description. But until then, you can get a hold of us at mail@reformedforum.org or Twitter @reformedforum. We love interacting with thoughtful comments and funny comments, but snarky comments, not so much, but we'll see. all that's available, and we do want to thank everybody for listening and watching. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.